I next met with Dr. Ruth O'Regan, whose oral presentation at ASCO of the so-called Bolero 3 Phase 3 trial evaluated the addition of the mTOR inhibitor everolimus to trastuzumab and vinorelbine in patients with HER2-positive metastatic disease. I met with Dr. O'Regan to hear about this important study and other research she's conducting, and to begin, she commented on the backgrounds of Bolero 3.
One of the things that's been seen in some of the preclinical data in trastuzumab-resistant models, breast cancer models, is that there is activation of the PI3 kinase pathway. Now, this can happen either through increased signaling through other growth factor receptors rather than HER2, such as HER3 or insulin growth factor receptor 1, or it can happen constitutively, or it can happen through P10 loss. So what we've done is we've done a couple of early phase trials looking at the idea of inhibiting mTOR as a means of enhancing the activity of trastuzumab and maybe reversing resistance to trastuzumab. So one of the first trials we did looked at a combination of paclitaxel trastuzumab given weekly with everolimus. And those patients in the study were very heavily pretreated. They all had trastuzumab-resistant disease, all had prior taxane exposure. And we actually saw a very high clinical benefit rate of more than 70% in that trial. And what was interesting was that if you looked at the patients who had definitively trastuzumab and taxane resistance by the criteria of the trial, they actually got even more benefits. So that was kind of a proof of principle that inhibiting mTOR could potentially reverse resistance to trastuzumab and enhance the activity of trastuzumab. So Bolero 3, there's, as you know, several Bolero trials. The Bolero 1 and Bolero 3 are the ones that are for patients with HER2-positive breast cancer, Bolero 1 being done in the first-line setting. Bolero 3 was basically designed on this proof of principle that adding in or inhibiting mTOR with everolimus could improve outcome for patients with trastuzumab-resistant breast cancer. So this is a randomized trial. All patients had prior trastuzumab, all patients had prior taxanes, and they were randomized to essentially vinorelbine on a weekly schedule with trastuzumab weekly with or without everolimus. Now, everolimus was given at 5 milligrams daily on the trial because in the initial phase 1b trial that was done, that was the maximum tolerated dose taken forward. Basically, what the study showed was that it did meet its primary endpoint in that the addition of everolimus to trastuzumab and vinorelbine did significantly improve progression-free survival with a hazard ratio of 0.78. Numerically, the difference wasn't that impressive. It was just about 1.2 months in favor of the everolimus arm.
Also, I mean, the hazard rate's not all that great either.
No, it was, I think, 0.78 on the study. Now, the survival's not mature yet, but there is a trend to the survival being better. And that may be meaningful in this study because they were a pretty heavily pretreated group of patients. I think only about 20% were treated in the first line setting, and there was about 40% who were treated in the third line or later setting. So pretty heavily pretreated group of patients. So obviously the survival analysis is going to be very important on this study.
So, of course, the clinical question here is, what does it mean? And are there situations, particularly, and I'm going to ask you in a second about this issue of the ER-positive, HER2-positive, because you already have justification for using something like everolimus just by ER positivity. But just sort of putting that aside, focusing on the HER2-positive aspect of this, I guess one question is, do you think buried in these sort of modest results might be a small number of patients who benefit a lot?
Absolutely. I think the subgroup analysis that was done on the study was quite interesting, and we'll talk about the estrogen receptor issue. So we have samples on about 40% of patients on the study, and we are doing correlative analysis on that, including really looking at, you know, different parts of the PI3 kinase pathway, mutations of the PI3 kinase pathway, P10, et cetera, you know, the standard things that you would look at there. The results from that will be reported at ESMO, and I think they'll be quite interesting because I think there is an indication that there are some subgroups that benefit. Although I will say from the data that we have so far, in my mind was most striking was the fact that the benefit was fairly significant in the ER-PR negative cancers, but there really wasn't a difference in the ER-positive, PR-positive group.
That's kind of interesting. Any explanation for it? I mean, I don't know if you can really generalize this from, I guess it was the Bolero 1 study in ER-positive disease, But I mean, wouldn't you expect there ought to be a benefit if there was ER positive metastatic breast cancer?
Yeah, I think that that's a very interesting issue. So, you know, obviously Bolero 2 showed, and we have actually a trial looking at this as well, that using everolimus in cancers that probably are hormone resistant appears to reverse resistance. You know, HER2 positive cancers by their nature tend to be hormone resistant. So you would have perhaps expected a benefit in that group. I think this is a very interesting question, because if you look at pretty much all the studies that have been done in HER2 positive, hormone receptor positive cancers, there tends to be a little bit less benefit in hormone receptor positive compared to hormone receptor negative. And I think what might be happening here is that we've kind of lumped all HER2 positive hormone receptor breast cancers together, but there may well be a subset in there that's perhaps driven by estrogen receptor. And maybe the reason we didn't see a benefit in that group in Bolero 3 is because we were inhibiting HER2 and giving chemotherapy, but we were not inhibiting estrogen receptor.
So these people were not allowed to have hormone therapy, or that was up to the doc?
Not while they were on the trial. Because in general, we don't do that for metastatic disease. So that was not allowed on the trial, as far as I'm aware. And that's pretty consistent across pretty much all the trials that have been done. And the reason that's important is because I think if you look at the preclinical data that's out there, there is quite a bit of evidence that there's a lot of crosstalk between the HER2 and ER pathways, and that if you just inhibit HER2, estrogen receptor can start acting as an escape mechanism. So I think when we presented the data at ASCO, there was a lot of interest in this. And this was on top of Lisa Carey's neoadjuvant study that had shown what we'd seen in almost every other neoadjuvant HER2 positive study, that the PATCR rate is always lower in hormone receptor positive HER2 positive cancers compared to hormone receptor negative HER2 positive cancers.
So, yeah, that kind of makes sense. So you don't have hormone therapy on board, so you can't kind of make it better, I guess. Can you describe a clinical situation, or maybe you've actually had patients outside a trial setting? Of course, there's always a reimbursement issue unless, you know, pending an official approval of the use of this agent in this exact situation. I don't know how easy or hard it might be to actually access it, but can you describe a situation of a patient with metastatic HER2 positive disease? You describe the case, ER positive, whatever it might be, where you'd want to use or think about using everolimus.
I think based on the data from Bolero 3 that we have, I would probably lean towards using it in patients with ER-PR negative cancers that have gone through the other treatments that we have, including pertuzumab and trastuzumab DM1 and perhaps lapatinib. That might be a group where you're kind of running out of options for those patients. I think one of the questions is, could you maybe treat a patient with an ER-positive, HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer with hormonal therapy in combination with trastuzumab and everolimus? And there is quite a bit of interest in looking at that approach. We're actually trying to work with Novartis to do a neoadjuvant study looking at that combination. But I think that's kind of an important question. But based on the Bolero 3 data, I think pending what we'll see at ESMO in terms of the correlative studies, I would probably consider using it, if I get it approved, for patients with hormone receptor negative HER2 positive cancers that had basically gone through the other typical agents. Bolero 3, there was a handful of patients who'd had prior pertuzumab, and also some of them had had prior trastuzumab DM1 as well. So we can't look to see whether those patients benefited or not, but at least for heavily pretreated patients, I think that might be a reasonable option.
Seems like there ought to be a lot of people out there who've got ER positive, HER2 positive disease who are receiving hormone therapy and anti-HER therapy, you know, maybe after, you know, initial chemotherapy when they get to that maintenance phase. And I could envision a situation like as you described, again, in a patient who's going through some of the more recent options that became available, maybe somebody who's, you know, on hormone therapy and anti-HER therapy and progressing, not too many options, maybe adding in everolimus on top of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very good actual thought. I think that probably would be possible to get the drug because, again, they are ER-positive metastatic breast cancers.
Right.
So I think that that certainly would be an area that would be worth looking at as well. But I think, obviously, survival data will be mature, I think, early or first or second quarter of next year. So that will really help us to see what the real benefit is. But I've actually asked Novartis to consider doing some central estrogen receptor and progesterone receptor analysis on this trial if they can, because those are all local hormone receptor analysis they presented.
So just kind of taking a step back, I see that you have a paper in Therapeutics and Clinical Risk Management with Dr. Paplamada, New and Emerging Treatments for Estrogen Receptor Positive Breast Cancer Focus on Everolimus. Can you talk about what you went through in this paper and at this point, you know, how you use everolimus in your own practice?
So this paper was basically a review of the studies that have been done looking at everolimus in estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. So we looked, obviously, in the metastatic setting at the results of BOLERO-2 and the TAMRAD study. Also, which is interesting, actually, and it was actually just published, there it was a first-line study looking at temsirmolimus with letrozole in patients with ER-positive metastatic breast cancer, which was actually a negative study, which I think is interesting because it begs the question of whether these inhibiting mTOR may be more effective in cancers that are truly resistant to endocrine therapy. So I think that's always been an issue when we've looked at these targeted agents in the first line setting. You know, there's a lot of negative studies.
What about side effects? And of course, everolimus has been out there already in renal cell for a while. I'm not sure whether it's exactly analogous, but at this point, oncologists are starting to get experience with it in breast cancer. What's the profile for this agent? And what do you say to a patient about to begin it?
I typically go through the more common side effects, which of course are the mouth sores or the things that are typically a problem. We've seen rashes, nail changes with the drug. Also, I think one of the tricky things is the metabolic abnormalities. So hyperglycemia and hyperlipidemia, we've seen that in patients as well. Not really sure how we should manage those in general, but you know, I've had a few patients who are diabetic where they've definitely ended up having more elevated blood glucose while they've been on everolimus. It's generally pretty manageable. The mouth sores, I think, are the most tricky thing. So you have to be pretty proactive with the mouth sores, and using magic mouthwash, particularly magic mouthwash that contains steroid, appears to be helpful. We've certainly used that. But the reality is, I think one of the problems that we run into is the fact that you're kind of like trying to find the right dose for your patient. I do start with 10 milligrams on every patient, but I do end up reducing the dose to 5 milligrams or even 2.5 milligrams a day in patients that don't tolerate it. One of the things I've noticed anecdotally only is that there does appear to be some relationship between body mass index and how they tolerate the drug. I've noticed some of the patients I've had that have had low body mass index actually have more problems, which I think makes perfect sense, actually. So we're actually working with one of our PharmDs to try and do a PK study in our breast patients to see if we can be a bit more intuitive about what's the right dose for an individual patient. I do think it's important to start with 10 milligrams in the ER positive setting because that's what was done in the trial, and then dose reduce if you need to. Because I think the problem is if you start at 5 milligrams, there may be patients that actually need 10 milligrams and you're kind of missing that window by starting at 5 milligrams. So that's typically what I've done.
When you use the 10 milligrams, you know, roughly what percent of these patients then need some kind of dose reduction?
I would say, you know, obviously we're looking at this in our trial, but I would say a fair number, at least a quarter of them do, I would think, maybe a little bit higher than that.
Well, it still sounds like more than half don't.
That's at least in my experience. But again, I really do think that we do need to do some more performance analysis. Most of the PK that was done with everolimus was done in immunosuppressed patients. So we don't have really much data in, you know, these patients that really aren't immunosuppressed.
What about pneumonitis?
So pneumonitis, I haven't seen as being a problem. You know, I think one of the things that you do see on CAT scans is, as you're obviously doing CAT scans to restage them, you do see some interstitial markings and some kind of nonspecific findings like that, which are probably pneumonitis. But generally, if they're not clinically symptomatic, I really haven't done anything about it. I've done PFTs in a few patients, and you do see some drops in DLCOs. But in general, I haven't had to take anybody off for pneumonitis or dose reduce for pneumonitis. So I haven't found that to be a huge problem.
So is it appropriate or adequate to follow up for pneumonitis by just asking for symptoms?
I mean, I think it is. I mean, you know, I think if you look at the data, there was probably somewhat of an overcall of pneumonitis in some of the earlier trials, mainly because of what you were seeing on the imaging. But I think obviously you have to be careful. I've had a few patients that maybe had some wheezing, but really at the end of the day, I wasn't clear it was from the everolimus and it certainly didn't worsen. So that I usually follow them clinically. But as I said, I think the metabolic issues are the things that we kind of struggle with quite a bit, because do you really have to treat somebody with a high cholesterol when they're going to be on the drug for a relatively short time? I just think there's a lot of questions like that we don't know the answer to.
So I want to ask you about a couple of papers you're involved with that are more along the HER2 negative line and also adjuvant. But I'm going to just take a breath here and insert a question that I got by email. I'm always receiving emails from docs in practice who have cases they want me to run by investigators, and I think a lot of times they are just directly contacting investigators. But anyhow, Dr. Marvin Diaz-Lucayo from Aventura, Florida writes, if 5 years ago, a 59-year-old African-American woman was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer. Liver biopsy proved ERPR negative, HER2 positive by FISH tumor, and treated with TCH, had a complete response, kept on single-agent trastuzumab until 6 months ago when she had a relapse in the liver. Biopsy again revealed ERPR negative, HER2 positive disease. The patient was kept on trastuzumab and nab-paclitaxel was added. After 6 cycles of this, she's in complete remission. Dr. Diaz-Lucayo wants to know what to do.
Well, so I think this is one of these patients that we actually like treating because they clearly have cancers that are pretty sensitive to trastuzumab. It sounds like she was on single-agent trastuzumab for almost 4 years before she had progression. I mean, I have to say, I would probably just leave her on single-agent trastuzumab because her disease has shown us that it is effective in these patients. And I've certainly had patients, admittedly, before we had all these other new agents, where I've done exactly what he did, where you give chemo, stop the chemo, leave them on trastuzumab, give them more chemo, put them back on the trastuzumab. And they actually do pretty well, I think. I mean, so I don't see any urgency with this patient of rushing in and giving her trastuzumab DM1 or adding in pertuzumab. Based on the data we have so far, we'll probably save that. So that would probably be what I would do with her.
So just kind of looking back on this case, if she were to present to you, and I'm not sure the exact timing relevant to the approvals of pertuzumab and T-DM1, but if you were to see a patient who, like this one, had a great response to chemo trastuzumab, long time on trastuzumab, and then with disease progression, how do you generally think through what to do there? And what about adding in pertuzumab?
Yeah, I mean, I think we don't know the answer to that. I think what he did was totally reasonable. And obviously, she had a really good response from it. I mean, you could probably make a case for saying, well, this is almost first line because, you know, she's been off chemotherapy for such a long time. So, I mean, I think you could have considered using trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and docetaxel or indeed paclitaxel at the time that he gave her the nab-paclitaxel. But the question then comes, when you want to take them off the chemo component, what do you do? Obviously, what we've done before is just use trastuzumab, but, you know, could you just use pertuzumab and trastuzumab? And I think that's an attractive option. Unfortunately, we don't have any data kind of supporting that approach at this time point. And I think this patient's pretty unique because she did so well on single-agent trastuzumab, so I wouldn't feel compelled to do that. And obviously, that's going to be more costly than just having her on trastuzumab.
Well, on the other hand, you can make the argument that she was demonstrating clinical progression on single-agent trastuzumab. Maybe you want to do something more. Again, I'm not sure exactly when this happened, but I also would have thought that at that point, if a patient progressing on trastuzumab after having chemo in the past, T-DM1 must be on the table.
Yeah, I think that would have also been a good option. Again, you kind of get to the point, though. So, you know, what we've always done before is give 6 cycles of chemo with trastuzumab and stop the chemo. What do you do with T-DM1 in that situation? Do you give 6 cycles and what do you transition them into? Now, obviously, it's a well-tolerated drug, but, you know, there are some issues with it and, you know, like the thrombocytopenia and elevated liver function tests. So I think they're all questions we don't know the answer to. I do think this patient is somewhat unique because I think we've all seen patients like this and we've all seen patients like this before we had pertuzumab and trastuzumab DM1. And that's why I wouldn't be adverse to just trying her on single agent trastuzumab and just watching her because you may get another 2-3 years on single agent trastuzumab in this patient.
Any comments on the fact that he chose to use nab-paclitaxel? You know, I kind of been wondering what's going on with that agent since Hope Rugo's presentation at a previous ASCO meeting suggested there wasn't any real benefit over paclitaxel. Do you ever use NAB in your own practice?
I do sometimes. I mean, I have to say, obviously, that was a fairly conclusive study because, you know, it also showed it appeared to have somewhat more toxicity as well. But I tend to use that in patients who maybe have had paclitaxel recently in the adjuvant setting. And, you know, you want to use, you know, different agent because it probably penetrates the cancers a little bit better than paclitaxel. But I probably would not have used nab-paclitaxel in this setting. I mean, I probably would have used docetaxel, pertuzumab, and trastuzumab in this patient. I agree with you. I'm not exactly sure, you know, where nab-paclitaxel is going. I know there's some interest in looking at it in the triple negative setting, which I think is reasonable. But I do think Hope Rugo's study certainly was important. And certainly I personally do like weekly paclitaxel as an agent that's easy to give and works well for patients.
So I want to move on to another kind of related topic in terms of genomic profiling in choosing adjuvant therapy. I see you actually have a review article looking at genomic subtypes in choosing adjuvant therapy. And then you had an abstract at ASCO. Let me see. It was a poster, actually, at ASCO. It was interesting. You were the senior author, it looks like. Phase 2 trial evaluating the use of the 21 gene recurrence score to select preoperative therapy in patients with hormone receptor positive disease.
Yeah, so this is a study, again, we started a number of years ago. You know, obviously we have TAILORx is pending, which is kind of the, you know, going to be the gold standard adjuvant study for looking at the 21 gene recurrence score in node negative breast cancer. But as you know, very often we're in a situation where we need to give patients preoperative treatment. And I think as oncologists, we kind of were, you know, rubbing our hands together when we were seeing patients with these lower grade cancers, giving them chemo, and the cancers really don't budge very much at all. So what this trial, it's actually a combination of two trials. What we were attempting to do here was to kind of use the 21 gene recurrence score to help us select therapies in the preoperative setting. So it really had a pretty similar design to TAILORx, where, or the same cutoffs rather, where if the patient would come in to see us, we'd send the 21 gene recurrence score as part of the trial on the biopsy. If the score was over 25, they went ahead and got chemotherapy with docetaxel cytoxin. If the score was less than 10, we would just give them preoperative endocrine therapy, and then we randomize the middle group, essentially. So there's very small numbers on this trial so far, because what ended up happening with this was that a lot of times patients, we would send the 21 gene recurrence score, and particularly if it came back with a low risk score, they did not want to get randomized to chemotherapy. They either went straight to surgery or we gave them preoperative endocrine therapy. But we did see, you know, a PATCR rate of about 20% or so in the patients with high recurrence scores who got the docetaxel cytoxin, which is kind of in keeping with what's been seen before, maybe a little bit higher. But interestingly, in the group we randomized between 11 and 25, there were no PATCRs at all in the patients who got chemotherapy in that group. Although I think it's very clear that chemotherapy can downstage these cancers, because radiologically they were getting a decrease in the size of the cancer, they just weren't getting a PATCR. One of the problems that we struggle with preoperative endocrine therapy is not giving it long enough. So the way we designed this is that the patients got the preoperative endocrine therapy for at least 6 months. And we tried to keep them on it until they got maximum response. So we were doing ultrasounds every 2 months on the patients on the study. I would say that it's very unclear how long you have to give it for in that setting. And the other problem, of course, is that we know that PATCR is not that important in these ER-positive cancers, particularly these luminal AER-positive cancers.
So I think even taking a step back, just the basic idea of even looking at a genomic predictor in the neoadjuvant setting is interesting, and I'm not really sure how much that's done outside of a trial setting. What are your thoughts? I mean, it kind of makes sense for that matter. There's a paper at ASCO looking at the 21 gene recurrence score metastatic disease. I mean, you would think if you're trying to, you know, identify the biology of a patient's tumor, that if they're not chemo responsive, that might be useful information in the neoadjuvant and maybe the metastatic setting. But I don't know. What do you think?
No, I think that's completely true, because the biology of these cancers is such that if you've got a low recurrence score cancer, it doesn't matter whether you treat patients preoperatively, postoperatively, or indeed in the metastatic setting, chemotherapy is probably not going to do much for these patients. I think the metastatic study was actually very interesting. I think a lot of us had thought that would be an interesting thing to look at. Of course, we all have patients that unfortunately progress very quickly to endocrine therapy in the metastatic setting, and it may be worthwhile identifying them early on with molecular profiling. So I think that was a very interesting study. One of the questions I would have, though, which I don't know the answer to, is in the metastatic setting, is it possible that you start with a cancer that has a low recurrence score, but as they become resistant, where you get perhaps more HER2 signaling or higher Ki-67, does the recurrence score actually increase with time? And maybe you're more likely to benefit from chemotherapy later on in the course of the disease than you are in the beginning, and we just don't know the answer to that.
So maybe I could create a scenario of a patient who's very, very symptomatic for metastatic ER-positive, HER2-negative disease. You really want to see them respond as soon as possible. If I were to say to you, if I could magically pull up a recurrence score from that point, not from when they were adjuvant therapy, would it be helpful in deciding, you know, for example, if they have a low recurrence score instead of, you know, what typically might be done, which would be give them chemo for a while and then hormones, just to hold off on the chemo and start the hormones?
I think that would be a very reasonable use. In fact, I would think that that would be a patient that you really might want to know that information on, you know, rather than the patient that you really believe by everything that you have that they are going to respond to endocrine therapy. So I think that would be useful because, again, you know, why would it be different really in the metastatic setting versus the early stage setting? So I think we all know that these estrogen receptor positive breast cancers really are, they biologically differ from each other quite a lot. And I think the more we learn about that, the better we're going to do a job in treating the patients.
I guess we should say that that kind of strategy certainly might be considered more experimental than anything else. I'm not suggesting it. It just seems like it might make some sense. You know, along the same lines, I was interviewing Dr. Norman Walmark from the NSABP, and we were talking about the CALOR study looking at local recurrence. And he was saying he sends that for Oncotype, which, you know, again, it sort of makes sense. But anyhow, what about local recurrence? How are you thinking that through nowadays in view of these findings that came out at San Antonio suggesting that pseudo-adjuvant therapy after removing a met surgically adds benefit?
Yeah, I think that study, I think, was kind of confirmatory of a lot of, I think, what we were doing. Obviously, it showed a greater benefit for the chemotherapy in estrogen receptor negative breast cancers, which makes perfect sense. As far as what Dr. Walmart does, I think that's something that is very interesting because one of the problems is that it's a little bit hard to get the recurrence covered by insurance. That's one of the issues that's come in. If you can kind of say, well, maybe it's a second primary, it's much easier to get it done. But if it's a local recurrence, it's very hard to get it done. But I mean, when you think about it, most of these patients, if they've got ER-positive breast cancer to start with, have been on some form of endocrine therapy. So it's very realistic to think that their recurrence score may have changed over that period of time. And I do think that's helpful because if the recurrence score is higher, then for sure, of course, you're going to want to give them chemotherapy. So the results are definitely interesting. And certainly, it very much supports us going in and giving further chemotherapy to our patients in this setting.
You know, Dr. Walmark likes to be provocative. So, you know, he was mentioning, though, that the issue about insurance and, you know, when they come back to him and say, well, what is this? And he goes, well, you know, it's breast cancer tissue, but I'm not sure we've really quite got there yet in terms of that. Where are you today right now in terms of using genomic predictors, both in ER positive or HER2 negative disease, that, you know, the situation where a lot of people are thinking about the 21 gene recurrence score, but also in terms of other situations, ER negative disease, HER2 positive disease, and other assays, including the mammoprint?
We routinely use the 21 gene recurrence score in pretty much all node negative breast cancers, unless they're really tiny, because I've actually run into a couple of patients recently where one of the surgeons has sent it on a 6 millimeter cancer, it comes back at 24, and you're kind of like, well, what am I going to do with that information? But in general, we do use it. I do use it on quite a lot of patients with 1 to 3 positive lymph nodes, although my preference is to put them on the SWOG 1007 study. Again, our surgeons are pretty proactive about sending the 21 gene recurrence score, so I kind of have to remind them to send them over to us first so we can get them on the study. But we've used it very widely, and we have a fairly large database of the patients that we've sent it on. For the HER2 positive setting, so this is a very interesting area, and that was one of the cases that I gave you. I think overall, unfortunately, for ER positive, HER2 positive breast cancers, molecular profiling has been not studied to a great amount. And the reason for that is that with the 21 gene recurrence score, what they found was that if the cancer was ER positive and HER2 positive, the recurrence score always ended up in the intermediate high or high risk range. And actually, we wrote a review in this last year where we actually put those results in because they actually have never actually been, as far as I'm aware, actually presented anywhere. So the reason for that is that the 21 gene recurrence score is somewhat dependent on proliferation. And we know, of course, that HER2 positive cancers tend to have a lot of proliferation genes. Now, the interesting thing about it is that the 70 gene signature, there is a study that was done where they actually did look at it in HER2 positive cancers. And what they found was, and I believe all of these cancers were triple positive, it was a very small number, but they did find that there was a subgroup within these HER2 positive cancers that actually had a good signature, which again was a little bit contrary to what we would have thought, because again, the 70 gene signature also has a lot of weight on proliferation genes, but they were able to tweak that out.